This is Talk Is Cheap on KPWLP 97.3 FM, Eugene Peace Works Independent Community Radio. This week, excerpts from the J20 demonstrations in Los Angeles. And something I've been researching. Please use your brain at all times. Use your own brain and research this stuff yourself. But just something I've been realizing is, do we really want a Riviera, even if it was... Do we really want a Riviera in Gaza? Every time I look up a Riviera, there's a hotel workers' strike going on, and they don't pay hotel workers very well in the Spanish, the French, or the Italian Riviera. It's as if the word Riviera is Italian for workers' strike, hotel workers' strike. So here's a little... thing that I found online. Again, I'm just using this to illustrate my point. Please research this stuff yourself. This is from AP, from August 9th, 2024. Rome, Italy. On the Ligurian Riviera, nestled between Genoa and the French border, the commune of Spatarno is one of Italy's tourist hotspots. This was once a historic municipality with the ruins of 16th century castle on green hillside overlooking the crystal clear waters. Given Spatarno's natural beauty, it's easy to see why such a picture-perfect destination would be popular, and yet almost the entire coastline is privatized. In Liguria, almost 70% of the region's beaches are private, with the average price for two sun loungers and an umbrella reaching 35 euros. Renting the beaches is low cost for owners, with licenses automatically renewed and often passed down within families, reaping lucrative rewards. But as EU legislation looks set to plunge businesses into choppy waters, Italy's concessionaires have taken a stand. On Friday morning, beach resort workers went on strike between 7:30 a.m. and 9:30 a.m. over EU plans for their resorts. Concessionaires closed beach umbrellas and sun loungers, but other services remained open, including beach bars, toilets, and showers. In 2006, EU legislation was approved to mean Italy's beaches would be put up for public tender in January 2025 and reallocated in a fairer bidding process. The symbolic strike from concessionaires on Friday protested against the imminent shakeup, which threatens the futures of their businesses, and the lack of action from the Italian government. Around 30,000 concessionaires argue that the EU legislation will cause job losses and will threaten livelihoods, demanding a national policy implemented by the Italian government to guarantee at least 2 years worth of turnover in compensation. It should be clear to everyone that there is a real and concrete risk of losing jobs and businesses, and that help from the government is needed now, or it will be useless, the Italian Beach Concessionaires Union said. If no response is received, the strike will be repeated on August 19th and August 29th with possibly more drastic closures. Not all beach resorts, however, decided to follow suit by going on strike. Fabrizio Licordari and Bettina Boia, presidents of Asso Balneari, which represents workers of tourist beach resorts, did not believe it was fair to punish tourists through the strike disruption. It isn't fair to penalize thousands of tourists that have chosen Italian resorts for their holidays, recognizing their quality and functionality. Private ownership of Italian beaches has been a long-standing and contentious issue. The Italian Environmental Association, Legambiente, estimated approximately 50% of Italy's sandy coastline is privately owned. The remaining free beaches often have limited space and, in extreme cases, are polluted and off-limits for swimming. In June, 12 activists were charged after participating in an unauthorized protest against a beach club on the Adriatic coast. The organization Mare Libero has also been advocating for a change on Italy's coasts, demanding a fairer reallocation of resorts or free access. All right, so, what Riviera for who in the Gaza Strip? So, coming up... excerpts from the January 20th protests in Los Angeles. Thanks for listening. Tell your friends, support independent media. This is the MIMO Moment with stories reported from the Middle East Monitor. This from February 4th, 2025. Syrian transitional president Ahmed al-Sharaa was discussing economic ties on a visit to Turkey on Tuesday as Turkish transport and manufacturing firms eye big expansion plans for Syria in what some expect will be a tripling of trade, Reuters reports. Turkish exports to the neighboring country rose 20% in December when Sharaa's forces ousted former Syrian President Bashar al-Assad and jumped by more than 38% in January, Turkish Exporters Assembly data show. Heads of Turkish companies and associations told Reuters they were making new freight connections and capacity investment plans in war-scarred Syria, and they expect economic ties to grow significantly. Turkish President Tayyip Erdogan's office said it would discuss with Sharaa possible joint measures to rebuild the country's economy. Turkey, which has emerged with the closest ties with Damascus after having backed anti-Assad rebels during Syria's 13-year war, is Sharaa's second foreign visit since he became transitional leader following his trip to Saudi Arabia. Underscoring Syria's immediate need to rebuild, Turkish machinery exports there soared 244% last month, while cement, glass, and ceramics jumped 92% and metals rose 73%. Fruit and vegetable exports also more than tripled. Exports could be more than $6 billion if trade were not hurt by developments in Syria in the last 13 years, said Bilgehan Engin, president of the Turkish Forwarding and Logistics Association, adding it could reach this level in 2 to 5 years. Last year, Turkish exports to Syria stood at $2.2 billion, while its imports from Syria were $437 million, official data show. Trade currently runs through a buffer zone at the Bab el-Hawa border crossing, where Turkish trucks transfer cargo to Syrian trucks due partly to security concerns. Exporters and business leaders said this raises costs and shipping time. Engine said a bilateral agreement to eliminate the buffer zone and free up Turkish transport movement inside Syria would allow trade to expand. Turkey's trade ministry said last month that Syrian and Turkish authorities agreed to start talks to revive a free trade agreement and deepen cooperation in transport, contracting, and investment across Syria. Ibrahim Fuat Askareki, head of the Turkey-Syria Business Council, has said that Turkey aims to reach $10 billion in bilateral trade in the medium term. Turkish Airlines is one of a handful of carriers to have resumed flights to Damascus after a 13-year suspension. In a major shift from decades of corrupt state control, Syria's new Islamist leaders are undertaking a radical overhaul toward a free market economy, welcoming investment, the new economy minister Basil Abdel Hanan told Reuters last week. In response, Turkey has moved to assist in providing electricity, setting up a maritime demarcation deal, and reestablishing banking ties. Syria will offer great opportunities in logistics, and we are making preparations, including new investment plans in the Iskenderun and Mersin dry ports, said Mehmet Atinsoy, general manager of Pacific Euro-Asia, which operates terminal services, railway, air, and sea transportation. The company will ramp up terminal investments to meet new Syria-related business, he said. Serdar Ayurtman, chief executive of Katoni Group, a freight forwarding and shipping services company, said shipowners have been reaching out to his firm to offer supplies for the expected rebuilding of Syria. There is talk of a $400 billion cake for the reconstruction of Syria, including infrastructure investments, power plants, other major construction, and project transportation, he said. Turkish companies may or may not undertake these projects, but logistically, Turkey's port and road infrastructure will be the key hub for transportation of goods. Syria's nearest ports are in Turkey and Lebanon. Along the 900-kilometer land border, some Turkish manufacturers are calling for a designated zone with Syria where they can produce at lower costs. It's becoming more difficult to find the labor force in Turkey and costs are increasing, said Ahmed Aksız, chairman of Istanbul Textile and Raw Materials Exporters Association. He said such a zone could also contribute to the return of some of the more than 3 million Syrian migrants in Turkey. Hatan Busek, a former board director at Turkish Syrian Business Council, said he was considering reopening a quarry in Akakle, 40 kilometers from the border, that had mainly served Syrian buyers, but that he had shut due to war there. Now we can reopen it as the demand reappears, said Bukak. This means employing at least 150 to 200 people in the region. Many other investments will come back, not just ours. This has been the Memo Moment with the stories reported in the Middle East Monitor. For KEPW News, I'm Curtis Blankenship. United Teachers of Los Angeles, Union Del Barrio, National Lawyers Guild, Women's March Action, Eastside Padres, and Centro CSO organized a protest rally against the Trump agenda and deportations on January 20th at Mariachi Plaza in Boyle Heights, a suburb of Los Angeles, California. The rally focused on what Trump has called the largest deportation operation in American history, and joined in solidarity with Mexico and other Latin American nations critical of Trump's plans. They also called for women and reproductive rights and a stand for Palestine. Cancel the Contract Antelope Valley is a coalition of community organizations and leaders from the Antelope Valley calling for the end of law enforcement violence and racism in our communities. They are calling on our cities and our schools to cancel the contracts with the LA Sheriff's Department and reinvest those dollars in a new vision of community safety and meaningful services for students and the community. Spokespersons Raquel Dorfler and Crystal Chavez spoke about the historical abuse of Latin Americans in the U.S.
Traveled here from the Antelope Valley, so that's the northernmost point of LA County, to stand in solidarity with you, our brothers and sisters, as we begin to fight again against another Trump administration and defend our communities. So we're here to educate the community that the new administration fully supports law enforcement, basically brutalizing our communities and standing with ICE and working with ICE in the name of law and order. But I'd like to share a little bit of my story. As you heard, my last name is Dorfler, but I'm actually a proud Latina. But I don't speak Spanish, and that's confusing to many in my community. I don't speak Spanish because my mother didn't speak Spanish. She grew up in the 1950s, 60s, was in high school in the 1960s, and my grandparents refused to teach their children Spanish because they wanted to make sure they were American as possible, Americanized, because if you did not speak English in those days, you were viewed as an other, as an enemy, someone who was to be deported. And we're headed in that direction now. That's where it's going to be pretty soon. So we want to just be here and to let you know that we'll be fighting with you.
My name is Crystal, and I'm with Pencil and Contract from Antelope Valley. I am here today to stand up for my family and for my neighbors. In the 1930s, during the Mexican repatriation, more than 2 million Mexican Americans were deported because the administration felt they were taking American jobs during difficult times. 40 to 60% of those were Mexican-American citizens born in the United States. And now this administration is coming for the 14th Amendment. They want history to repeat itself. Stand up with me. Stand up for our brothers and our sisters who are also at war. Women's rights are at stake. We will not stand quietly this time. We will not stand as our neighbors get deported. We will fight. We will fight.
For more information on Cancel the Contract Antelope Valley, go to ctcav.org. United Teachers of Los Angeles, Union Del Barrio, National Lawyers Guild, Women's March Action, Eastside Padres, and Centro CSO organized a protest rally against the Trump agenda and deportations on January 20th at Mariachi Plaza in Boyle Heights, a suburb of Los Angeles, California. The rally focused on what Trump has called the largest deportation operation in American history, and joined in solidarity with Mexico and other Latin American nations critical of Trump's plans. They also called for women and reproductive rights and a stand for Palestine. Chichi Navarro of Queer Mercado spoke about Dr. Martin Luther King's methods for positive social change.
Arriba mi gente latina! Así me gusta. All right, so I'm gonna make it a little bit more fun right now, because I get tired real quick and I still have my heels on. So what I'm gonna do is introduce myself. My name is Chichi Navarro. Any pronoun is okay with me. So I want us to thank Centro CSO. Give it up for Centro CSO today. That's right, and all the rest of the organization for making this happen. So I want to talk a little bit. I stand before you as a proud trans non-binary person, an atheist, a Mexican-American Angelino. I'm here on behalf of the Queer Mercado, which is an East LA-based organization that provides housing for people that are in here making business their thing, right? So if you are an LGBTQIA2+ individual that's running their own business or that wants to go and have a safe space to be at, that is the place for you. Now, I was raised in Mexico and here in the beautiful, in the state of Guanajuato, and have been called, have called Boyle Heights my home for the last 5 years. With its vibrant history of resistance and solidarity, it has shaped me into the person that I am today. This city has taught me the power of unity across cultures and struggles, and it fills me with pride to call it home. Yet I know that my gender expression, my sexuality, and my Mexican roots are often weaponized by right-wing forces to divide us. They use these aspects of my identity and the identities of so many others to distract us from the real enemy, the wealthy elites and corporations who thrive on our oppression. But I refuse to let their hate divide us. Our shared struggle is far greater than their attempts to pit us against one another. We are unstoppable. Today, as we honor Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., we must remember him not just as a dreamer, but as a revolutionary who challenged the very foundations of inequality in America. Dr. King's critique of capitalism was a courageous call to action, one that remains profoundly relevant today. He declared that, quote, something is wrong with capitalism, and demanded a, quote, radical redistribution of economic and political power to dismantle the interconnected evils of racism, militarism, and economic exploitation. King understood that this profit-driven system prioritizes material wealth over human dignity, and that it had outlived its usefulness for the oppressed masses. King's vision for economic justice was rooted in democratic socialism, a belief in policies like universal health care, guaranteed income, fair wages, and expanded public housing as essential tools to eradicate poverty and uplift marginalized communities. He championed the Freedom Budget, a bold plan for economic equality proposed by a socialist, A. Philip Randall, which called for job guarantees and living wages for all Americans. King knew that addressing poverty required more than charity. It required dismantling systems of exploitation at their core. Quote, you can't talk about ending slums without first saying profit must be taken out of slums. His words were not just critiques. They were calls to build an economy where human welfare mattered more than corporate profit. But Dr. King's genius extended beyond economics. He exposed capitalism's moral failure, the way it serves, the way it inspires people to value wealth over service to humanity. Capitalism is always in danger of inspiring men to be more concerned about making a living than making a life. He warned us. His dream was not just racial equality, but a society built on equity, collective responsibility, and shared humanity. A society where dignity is not reserved for the privileged few, but guaranteed for all. This vision stands in stark contrast to figures like Donald Trump, who embodies everything Dr. King fought against. Trump's policies and rhetoric thrive on division, on scapegoating immigrants, demonizing LGBTQ+ people, suppressing black voters, and upholding systems designed to benefit the rich at the expense of everyone else. As Project 2025 looms on the horizon, a calculated plan to strip away our rights while entrenching white supremacy and corporate greed, we must remember Dr. King's urgent call to solidarity across race, class, gender identity, sexual orientation, and every other line used to divide us. Today, we must serve as a rallying cry for Black and brown communities to come together in unity because our struggles are deeply interconnected. We face the same systems of oppression, the same white supremacists who hoard wealth while exploiting our labor and denying us justice. Despite our differences in identity or experience, we are bound by the same fight for liberation. Let this day remind us that when we stand together, we build bridges instead of walls. We have the power to transform society. No one is illegal on stolen land. Trans men are men and trans women are women. Black lives matter. Everyone must have food and shelter afforded to them. Religion should not be the law of the land. Mother Earth must be cared for. Healthcare is a right. Bodily autonomy must be respected. Prisons, aka legalized enslavement, must be abolished. Quality education and the violent history of this nation must be learned and acknowledged. Wars must be ended. Money must be taken out of politics. People must be prioritized over profits. And none of this can be accomplished if we allow our differences to divide us. The time is now. We must rise together. The people united will never be divided. The people united will never be divided. Thank you so much.
United Teachers of Los Angeles, Union del Barrio, National Lawyers Guild, Women's March Action, East Side Padres, and Centro CSO organized a protest rally against the Trump agenda and deportations on January 20th at Mariachi Plaza in Boyle Heights, a suburb of Los Angeles, California. The rally focused on what Trump has called the largest deportation operation in American history, and joined in solidarity with Mexico and other Latin American nations critical of Trump's plans. They also called for women and reproductive rights and a stand for Palestine. John Parker of the Harriet Tubman Center for Social Justice, Los Angeles, said Dr. Martin Luther King would have been appalled that Donald Trump would be inaugurated on a holiday that honors his work.
I'm very proud to be here with the other speakers here in this struggle. And you know, when the city officials and the government, they say, well, on the fires, well, there's nothing we could do. We didn't know that fires were going to be so intense. But they did know the winds were blowing. They did know that the power lines that should have been buried underneath and they should have known that it's black and brown communities where that didn't happen. They should have known that housing would be a necessity when your house is gone to bits and you need a place to stay. But they did nothing. They could have prepared by having other housing. I mean, Jesus, in 2 weeks during the COVID crisis, China built 2 hospitals in less than that time. So they could have done it, but it's the profit motive that they care about, not the needs of the people. They put the billionaires and the banks and the insurance companies above the needs of the people. You know, right now they've raised rents to 20%. The rents have gone up. We need a freeze. And they refused to prosecute the landlords who are doing this. This is a time of the fire when people need this. They're raising the rents. My goodness. Now, you know, today is the day when it was supposed to be the MLK celebration in Los Angeles. But the corporate people who put on that parade decided that they had to cancel because the cops had to go to the fire. And they wanted the cops to be at their parade. Well, isn't that something? You know, the cops and the National Guard, they're not over there fighting fires. They're criminalizing the people in need. That's what they're doing. They should take their guns away, give them a rake or something. But they're not doing that. And it's interesting that Martin Luther King would not want the cops at his parade. He wouldn't want the military there. Martin Luther King said, the greatest purveyors of violence today is my own government. We don't want the money going to the bombs that are killing children in Gaza. We don't want it that the money that's going away to the military complex and taking the things that we need. We don't want that. Martin Luther King would not want that. And we know that this is not a day of an inauguration of a fascist. This is a day of a courageous warrior for social justice. And they try to scare us. They try to tell people with ICE that we're going to do the raids, we're going to do that, we're going to do all this kind of stuff. But we're not afraid. We're not afraid of them. Like the Palestinian people who won't stop. We won't stop by any means. So you go ahead and you do your ICE raids. You build your clubs against our children, our black children and brown children. You try it. But you're only going to be able to do it so longer, because once in a while, we're not going to take it. We're going to come together, and we're going to fight back, and we're going to be a scary presence. Now, Martin Luther King said he wasn't afraid for his life. He said, I may not get there with you to the mountaintop. But he said, but it really doesn't matter. He said, with me now, because I've been to the mountaintop, I've seen the promised land. I may not get there with you, but I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land. We will get to the promised land. We will win. And I'm so glad. There's no contradiction in FRSO, CSO, Unión del Barrio, Struggle La Lucha, Harriet Tubman Center, other organizations, ILPS, and there's no contradiction in our coming together in unity and fighting back. There is no contradiction. That is the, so you know what, I like low tech. I like that spear, that African people. They got bombs, they got nuclear this, but they got that spear. And the spear, the tip of that spear is our unity. I'm so glad. I respect all of these organizations. I feel comfortable here. And I'm so glad we're here. Thank you for what you're doing. And let's get on. Let's keep fighting. Yeah. We're going to kick ass.
The Eugene chapters of the Democratic Socialists of America and the Party for Socialism and Liberation presided over one of many rallies and marches held around the United States to protest the extreme right billionaire agenda of the incoming Trump administration at the Eugene, Oregon Morse U.S. Courthouse on January 19th. Justin Phillips of the Pacific Green Party spoke about the current state of the United States system. He's introduced by Cameron of DSA.
All right, so our first speaker today is going to be Justin Phillips of the Pacific Green Party. Justin was the Green Party candidate for our congressional district in 2024. The Pacific Green Party runs campaigns to speak truth to power, highlight the systemic nature of our problems, expand the conversation on what is possible, and fight for a better future. Justin currently serves as the co-chair of the Eugene chapter of the Pacific Green Party. Justin, the floor is yours.
Thanks, Cameron. Hey, everybody. All right, today we gather here to fight against the billionaire agenda. How about if you're not a billionaire, let's hear you. Let's make some noise. All right. I probably don't need to tell you, the billionaire agenda has created immense wealth inequality in this country. Over the last 50 years, my lifetime, the top 1% of Americans have taken $50 trillion from the bottom 90%. If you're not part of the 1%, you're getting exploited. Tomorrow we honor Dr. Martin Luther King. 58 years ago and less than a year before his death, King said, "Why are there 40 million poor people in America?" When you ask that question, you begin to question the capitalistic economy. You begin to ask questions about the whole society. Today there are still roughly 40 million people living in poverty, and nearly 800,000 people are homeless. It's estimated that the number of unhoused people has grown by 18% just in the last year. Let's contrast that with, in 2012, Elon Musk Go ahead, let's boo it. 2012, Elon Musk was worth $4 billion. Today, he's worth more than $447 billion. In 2012, Jeff Bezos was worth $18 billion. Today, he's worth more than $249 billion. In that same time, there has been no increase in the federal minimum wage. That few can be so obscenely wealthy while many suffer is an indictment of the whole system. It's immoral. On Wednesday, President Biden warned of an emerging oligarchy or rule by an elite few. Thanks, Joe, but you're a little late to the game. It's been 10 years since a study from Princeton and Northwestern concluded that the U.S. is already an oligarchy. In the most recent presidential election, Trump was backed by 52 billionaires. Harris was backed by 83 billionaires. The other 678 sat it out, presumably because they know they will do well under either administration. For decades, we chose to elect political leaders who put the material interests of the rich and powerful above those of the American people. We can do better. The answer is not Donald Trump. He is not going to drain the swamp. He is the epitome of the swamp. He has used the office of the presidency to enrich himself and his wealthy friends. The Trump administration is going to bring with it its own special set of challenges for we the people. We have some great speakers here with us today who are going to talk a little bit about that. And while the challenges may change over time, they're all rooted in the same rot of greed and oppression. To fight effectively, we must understand who our enemy is. It is not our immigrant neighbor. It is not the poor. It's a capitalist system bent on producing greater and greater profits while exploiting people, their labor, and the environment. Donald Trump may be the latest face of imperialism and capitalism, but it is the capitalist imperialist system itself that is our enemy. We cannot expect one corporate party with a billionaire agenda to save us from the other corporate party with a billionaire agenda. We need a radical shift that puts people, the planet, and peace before profits. We have a different agenda. And to deliver the alternative, we're going to need an alternative vehicle for change. Be conscious of a media that controls and upholds this system. What stories do they choose to run or not run? Which voices are broadcast on the airwaves and in print? How do they manufacture consent? Be conscious of the ways they try to manipulate the narrative and divide us to keep us from forming class consciousness. We have a lot of great people working on issues that need our attention, but there's also a need to see the connection between all these issues and to organize against the system that creates the conditions for these problems in our society. Dr. King, in the last years of his life, told historian David Halberstam that he had abandoned the incremental approach to social change of his civil rights protest days in favor of pursuing, quote, a reconstruction of the entire society, a revolution of values, one which would look uneasily on the glaring contrast of poverty and wealth with righteous indignation. As we honor Dr. King and prepare to fight the next administration, let us continue to come together as we are today, to say we do not consent. I will not resign myself to being ruled by oligarchs. Don't forget, there are more of us than there are of them. I'm asking you today to be a visionary, to ask the questions King asked, and to create a better future for everyone, not just the 1%. Thank you.
On a recent installment of the Bradcast, heard Monday through Friday at 7 a.m. on KEPW, host Brad Friedman said Californians pay more in taxes to the federal government than they receive back in services. The city of San Diego has reported a $258 million tax deficit. The mayor has pledged to continue to fund priorities that matter to most San Diegans, including keeping neighborhoods safe, reducing homelessness, building more housing, and fixing the roads. In a sign of austerity, Democratic Mayor Todd Gloria spoke from city council chambers at San Diego City Hall instead of the historic Balboa Theater, where it's usually held. He said that some hard choices would have to be made, including a hiring freeze of city workers and halting non-essential spending. However, Mayor Gloria said pointedly that homelessness is a regional crisis and addressing it is not solely the city of San Diego's responsibility.
The city of San Diego can do hard things. In 2025, we are going to add conquering our structural budget deficit once and for all to our list of accomplishments. Having taken office as a city council member at the start of the Great Recession, I know a thing or two about balancing budgets at very tough times. However, this time, we cannot seek one-time measures that will only serve to prolong our pain for several years to come. It is my expectation that we handle the structural deficit this year. No gimmicks, no Hail Mary passes, no cavalry is coming to save us. We cannot wait yet for another revenue measure that might fail, and we certainly can't count on assistance from the federal government, which under the incoming administration is far more likely to burden us than to help us. Steep cuts will be necessary. But I also want to be clear that I'm not interested in just slashing our way to a balanced budget. Instead, we will reimagine how we operate, examining every service we provide and how we can make the most of the public assets that we have. We need to ask fundamental questions in the weeks and months ahead. Why are we doing it this way? And is there a better way? And we're going to seek to shift some of the burdens that do not belong on the backs of city taxpayers. And that's especially true when it comes to homelessness. I've said it before and it remains true. Addressing homelessness is not solely the responsibility of the city of San Diego. The city of San Diego cannot continue to shoulder the response to this region's homelessness crisis alone. Over the past 4 years, we have done the work to build up a homeless response ecosystem to get people off the streets, connected to care, and on a path to housing. Our city-funded outreach, shelter, and family reunification programs have served more than 25,000 people and successfully placed nearly 4,700 of them into housing. Along with these efforts comes the imperative to enforce our laws against unsafe and unsanitary encampments. In San Diego, we took a stand that we will not accept encampments that block sidewalks, forcing children to walk in the street just to get to school, and making it harder for customers to patronize businesses that employ our people and power our economy. Our unsafe camping ordinance is successfully reducing encampments in heavily impacted areas without widespread arrests. But simply, it is working. Implementing our comprehensive shelter strategy to reduce homelessness is my administration's number one priority. And it will continue to be this year. And we will, now hear me on this, we will, even with our difficult financial picture, we will increase options for people to get off the streets this year. We will open a new safe parking site at H Barracks, as well as other new shelter facilities. Because there are people who are still suffering out on our streets and sidewalks and canyons each and every night, and they need our help. So whether you're a community member or a member of this city council, understand that we are going to do more. We must do more, and I welcome your partnership to reduce homelessness, not your opposition. But the responsibility is not ours alone. Homelessness is a national crisis, up 18% nationwide, and it is present in every corner of our region. And for every city in our region, from San Marcos to Imperial Beach, they need to step it up. Because they too have vacant buildings that can be converted into shelters. They too have underused parking lots that can accommodate a safe parking program. They too have land where they can create a safe sleeping program. And they too can choose to build more houses. It's long past time for all cities in this county to do their part and not simply rely on you, the taxpayers of this city, to continue to foot the bill. It's also long past time for the county of San Diego to fulfill its responsibility on addressing homelessness in our region. Mental health and addiction are often at the core of homelessness. And behavioral health, mental health, and treatment for substance use disorder are all services that are supposed to be provided by county government. The City of San Diego does not have a Health and Human Services Agency, but the county does. They are the government entity vested with the responsibility and the funding for mental health. I live and work in downtown San Diego. Every single day, I see a serious mental illness that acts like a gravitational pull that keeps people on our streets. The city has done everything we can within our limited authority to help on this issue. We took a leading role lobbying the state of California to pass care court and conservatorship reform. We did our part to prepare the region to receive new state-funded mental health and detox beds by amending our land use code to make it easier to permit treatment facilities. And now it's time for the county to step up and deliver the behavioral health treatment for which they receive millions of dollars to get the very sick people living on the streets the care that they need. Over a year ago, the county board voted to delay implementation of the state law that makes it easier for people suffering from severe mental illness to access life-saving care. And it did little in this one-year delay to prepare for its implementation. And it has yet to take meaningful steps to address the very real shortage of behavioral health care beds. And when they fail to live up to their obligations, we are all left to pick up the pieces and pay the bills. It strains our police department, our paramedics, our hospitals, and makes all of us feel more unsafe. We cannot afford to absorb the impact of this inaction any longer. Enough is enough. My fellow San Diegans, it is my hope that anytime you see a person on the street suffering from extreme mental illness or addiction, that you think of the County of San Diego and ask, when will they step up to provide the services they need to end this crisis once and for all? There's another entity that also needs to follow through on their role to address the homeless crisis. Like you, I use our freeways every day and see the growing number of tents and garbage along on-ramps and underpasses. And like you, I find this to be absolutely unacceptable. It is dangerous for people living in these encampments. It distracts drivers and increases the risk of fires that our residents already know all too well. The City of San Diego, over the last year, has received on average 300 complaints per month about people experiencing homelessness and severe tent encampments on state property. Complaints that we refer to Caltrans because legally, the City of San Diego cannot go on the state property to clear encampments. The situation is dire and we need help. So if the state can't or won't address these areas, they should give the city full authority to do this work and then fully reimburse us for the cost of doing that work. We are ready. About this because it affects the bottom line of our city. Every dollar the city spends in responding to the lack of action from other cities, the county, or the state are dollars not being spent fixing your roads, upgrading our stormwater systems, or supporting public safety.
According to a 2015 study by the Rockefeller Institute, a conservative think tank, 37 states had a positive balance of payments with the federal government, receiving more spending than their taxpayers and economy paid for federal taxes and other federal receipts. New York was one of the only 13 states that had a negative balance of payments, including New Hampshire, Massachusetts, Connecticut, Texas, Colorado, Wyoming, Nebraska, North Dakota, Minnesota, Illinois, and California. Municipalities may have to resort to extreme measures to find needed infrastructure and services. According to the Social Security Administration, payroll taxes are used to fund Social Security. Payroll taxes go into the general fund. The Social Security Administration then estimates how much should go into the Social Security Trust Fund, not by how much states have sent, but by how much wages were paid based on employment records. States and employers could theoretically put their employee payroll taxes in an escrow account until the Fed stops sending money back to the states in the form of defense contracts. that tend to concentrate wealth and spend it instead on things like hospitals, housing, and infrastructure without affecting SSI funding. The Rockefeller Institute study seems to have a previously conceived agenda to say that the federal tax burden falls on the wealthy. One thing is true, if the federal government continues to tighten its belt, both rich and poor, liberal and conservative, will have to up the ante in the game of tax and spend to ensure their tax dollars are used properly, to support our local communities rather than subsidize multinational corporations with austerity programs. For KEPW News, I'm Curtis Blankenship. We'll be right back.
on your darkest night so painful? Do you have love for love midst the torture of being?